Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan, and my guest today is Bruce Perry, MD, PhD. I'm going to forego my usual up-to-dates of information and news in order to get quickly to work with Dr. Perry, who certainly is one of the most knowledgeable and interesting people that I could have on my show. He's familiar to many of you as the co-author of Born for Love, Why Empathy is Essential and Endangered. He's also the co-author of The Boy Who Was Raised as a Dog and Other Stories from a Child Psychiatrist's Notebook. Dr. Perry is doing a great deal of work in an area that is of great interest to me. I've been thinking a great deal lately and usually introduce my talks in various places in the country by examining the intricacy of the human brain, examining what we don't know about the human brain, about how the human brain is the most complex space in the universe, and how the child is born with this already most complex space in the universe, and then develops that space, that brain, in response to the environment in which the child is growing. So we essentially have neuroscience being the study of not only the most complex organ in the universe, far more complex, say, than the whole physical universe put together, but also a social organ grown in response to the socialization process, a psychosocial brain. And as I've gotten interested in this, I've looked at some of Dr. Perry's work and found that he's already been writing about this, and interestingly, some of the most interesting and articulate pieces that he's written, you can find just Googling his name and looking at occasional blog-type reports that he's put on the Internet, in addition to his books. I'm very interested in hearing his latest views on the development of the brain in response to trauma, and also naturally in response to the life around it. And to any other subjects that interest him, it's a great deal of pleasure. I welcome Dr. Perry to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
Thank you very much. I have to say I'm very honored to be here. I have followed your work for many years and have appreciated your role as sort of the conscience of our discipline, which, as I think we can probably agree, hasn't been listening very much to what you have to say.
Thank you for that. You know, when we got in touch with you, I had no idea whether you had any familiarity with my work at all. So it's a great pleasure to hear that you do, sir.
I do, and I have to say, I am trained as a neuroscientist. I have a PhD in neurobiology, and I was also trained clinically as a child psychiatrist. And the work that we've been doing in our working group over the years has been trying to integrate concepts that are emerging in neurodevelopment and neuroscience into clinical practice. And it's been a very interesting journey. And I have to say that one of the more sobering aspects of that process has been realizing that the mainstream views and mainstream teachings in psychiatry are actually very, very disconnected from the reality of how the brain develops and how the brain changes. And over time, one of the things that I really had to face was the undue influence on the way we categorize and create diagnostic labels, the way we carry out our research, the way we teach, and all of that, all of those things are influenced to a great degree by the corporations that basically manufacture medications used in neuropsychiatric disorders. And that's been a very sobering and kind of demoralizing experience, actually, to learn the degree to which that has impacted our discipline.
Yeah, I began writing about that in Toxic Psychiatry back in 1991, and I continue to be astonished and demoralized as others dig deeper and deeper in verifying a lot of those early observations. It's hard to tell the difference today between a psychiatrist and a salesman for the drug industry, or between the American Psychiatric Association and the pharmaceutical associations.
Well, there's no doubt that there's a tremendous amount of undue influence, and some of it is, I think, subtle and tacit and non-intentional, but a great deal of it is very intentional, very purposeful, and it's motivated by making a profit as opposed to really healing a patient. So it's one of the things that's going to have to happen hopefully in our lifetimes is a turn away from that recognition of the degree to which psychiatry has to clean its house and really move forward with science as a organizing principle, as opposed to the corporate sector being the major organizing principle. But it's a really hard, it's a significant dilemma, because a lot of people who are really decent people, very bright people, they're just not even aware of what they don't know. And I think that most people, and I was one of those people, I was trained in really what I thought were good training programs, and I think they were. And I learned conventional mental health, but I was really lucky to have a number of supervisors who were always questioning the conventional wisdom. And I was also very lucky, I think, to have a background in neurobiology, so that some of the things that people would say, someone would say to me, oh, well, this medication works because it increases serotonin in the synapse. And I would just laugh, because I knew that was ridiculous. It's a completely absurd mechanism. The brain's not a hydraulic pump. And the complexity of the brain is so significant that any transient change in the concentration of serotonin in the synaptic cleft will be compensated for by changes in receptor-effector coupling and internal, intracellular changes that lead or are attempting to maintain homeostasis. So these simplistic mechanisms that drug reps get into the heads of prescribing physicians are just absurd. And having been trained in neurobiology, I could say that. So I think that helped sort of break away from the inertia of our training, which is very powerful. It's very hard, as I'm sure you can attest, to feel like you are needing to marginalize yourself from the mainstream of your own discipline. But it's something that I think has to happen more and more. I mean, it takes a lot of courage to do it. And I have to say, take my hat off to your courage over the years in doing that.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Well, I didn't know really about your views in this regard. So I'm very glad to have you speaking out the way you are on the show today. I'd like to also... now, really get more into your particular research. By the way, not to minimize how grateful I am for the words you've spoken, to get into your particular research and what it is you're finding out about the developing brain and the even pre-birth and certainly after birth, and its relationship to trauma and to what ends up being called things like schizophrenia. I've been looking at some of your recent papers about that. I mean, you've just got a lot to talk about. Let me give you just a little bit of a free rein to introduce people to what you've been doing.
Sure. Really, my developmental perspective started many, many years ago when I was an undergraduate. And there's a gentleman who's a pioneer in neuroscience. His name is Seymour Levine. And he, many, many years ago, made the observation that little rat pups, newborn rats, if they were briefly handled by a human being, which for a rat is quite a significant stress, and then put back with their mother, that as they grew up, the biology of their brain was different, and particularly the biology of their stress response. And I was fascinated by the fact that you could have a developmental experience that was relatively brief, and that could change the entire functional capability and biology of the stress response. And so from that time forward, back in 1974, I've been thinking about and studying in different ways how experience influences the organization of the brain, and then what that means functionally. And of course, as I made my way through my training, I ran into lots of children who had been abused and neglected. And this is not an uncommon thing for you to see in a public mental health clinic. And they were initially presented as having attention deficit disorder or conduct disorder. And I realized pretty quickly that this is just that's not accurate. These kids had high resting heart rates. They would eat tons of calories and they wouldn't gain weight. They had increased startle responses, they had sleep problems, and they were literally just like the stressed animals that we were studying in our laboratory. And so I started to think about the fact that these symptoms that they were presenting, these behaviors, were essentially maladaptive persistence of an originally adaptive response. Because it's, you know, the stress response is really, when you are under threat, it's very adaptive for you to change your physiology. But because the brain changes in a use-dependent way, the more you activate these systems in these unpredictable and prolonged ways, the more likely you are to develop what we call sensitized systems. And so, rather than having linearity between external complexity and external stress and internal response, these children grew up with an overly active and overly reactive stress response. And for those of you who are listening, who are physicians, you may appreciate this. Those of you who are not, let me just explain a little bit about some of the biology that the stress response is actually a multidimensional and relatively pervasive set of physiological capabilities that involves the brain and the body. And so there's kind of a grand central station for all of the incoming information from your body and the outside world that's low in the brain. So the lower part of your brain has some of these centers that are processing all of the time incoming information from your body, you know, how much oxygen you have, is your blood pressure good, is your body temperature okay, and information from the outside world through your senses, through your eyes and your ears and your nose. And it's taking this information and it's sorting it and processing it, and then depending upon what the interpretation is, it will act on that information to hopefully keep you alive. So if you are dehydrated, your brain will get the signal that I need to seek out fluids. If you see a saber-toothed tiger pacing at the outside of your campfire, you activate your mechanisms to stay alert and to prepare to either flee or fight. And all of these things are adaptive. Now, the thing that's really important about the stress response is that it has the potential to recruit every part of the brain and every part of the body. So when your stress response systems become abnormally organized, you end up having functional consequences in your body and in your brain. And so let's start with the body. If the systems that are going out to control your lungs and your heart and your gut and your skin are overactive and abnormally reactive, you end up having increased vulnerability for heart disease and for lung disease and for diabetes and a whole bunch of other physical health problems. And you may be familiar with the ACE studies, you know, Dr. Folletti and his work on the relationship between early life adverse experiences and subsequent health in adult life. We think that the mechanism is related to this abnormally organized and sensitized stress response. So that's from this grand central station at the lower parts of the brain out to the body. If you then look at that, those parts of the brain as they send signals up to other parts of the brain, you realize that you're going to have difficulties in fine motor control. You're going to have difficulties in forming and maintaining relationships. You're going to have difficulties in cognition, thinking and learning, and speech and language. And that's exactly what we see. These children who have developmental trauma end up with higher rates of speech and language problems, learning problems, relational problems, motor problems, and you know, a whole range of mental health issues like depression and attentional problems. And so the relationship between developmental trauma and developmental insults, and it doesn't have to be trauma. It could be intrauterine hypoxia. It could be intrauterine exposure to drug. All of these things that alter those systems will have functional consequences. Now, if you take the typical child that has had these experiences, and then you put him in our current mental health and educational systems, this is where the real problem starts. We misunderstand these children. We misdiagnose them. We give them these labels like ADHD and conduct disorder, and then we start to medicate them. And so if you have a population of prescribers that are primarily educated by a pharmaceutical representatives, and you don't teach them any other therapeutic tool, any other therapeutic approach, you're going to have these kids end up on multiple medications. And that's exactly what happens. These kids end up being victims of polypharmacy. They're given antipsychotics for symptoms where there's no indication, there's not a shred of data that medication would help those symptoms, but they just keep getting prescribed these combinations of medications in an attempt to try and deal with a, quote, disorder that in fact doesn't even exist. So that one of the biggest challenges we've had in the last 10 years is trying to educate our peers about the impact of trauma. And fortunately, that's been happening relatively well. You know, there are people that are talking about the need for trauma-informed practice, but it's been a long and somewhat frustrating process. And of course, there's tremendous pushback from conventional psychiatry around relabeling things like ADHD and bipolar disorder and all of the current frame of reference that the field is using is not developmentally informed or trauma informed. So when these new perspectives come in, they push back. And so that's kind of where the field is right now. There's a lot of debate about, you know, labeling and treatment and evidence and that sort of thing. So that's a little bit of what we're involved in currently.
Now, you've been tracing, going back as far as, I guess, 2001 in a paper on the contributions of early traumatic events to schizophrenia.
Yep.
How early trauma could relate to what gets called schizophrenia, but presumably should be called something else. Could you talk some about that?
Yeah, it's interesting. Let me just sort of put this in context. I think many of you have probably thought about this, and I'm sure, Bregan, that you've thought about this. You mentioned that the brain is more complex than anything we know of. And And so let me talk a little bit about diagnostic labels. If you take the heart, the human heart, which has not that many cell types, it's a very simple organ, and I don't mean this to be flip to my cardiology friends. The truth is, structurally and functionally, it's quite simple. Its major function is to pump blood. Structurally, it's got nerve cells and it's got muscle cells, but really what it does is lub-dub, lub-dub. It pumps blood. Now, if you go to a cardiology textbook, you will find over 400 specific diseases and disorders. And these are tied to specific physiology. Now, the interesting thing is the symptoms for many of those 400 disorders are exactly the same. You know, you could, you know, half give chest pain, half of them will result in, you know, a whole bunch of other symptoms that are compared. Now let's go to the brain. If you think of the human brain has 100 billion neurons. It has 1 trillion glial cells. Each neuron has about 5,000 to 10,000 connections to neurons. Yet, and the brain mediates hundreds of unique functions. So in comparison to the heart, it's infinitely more complex. Yet if you go into a conventional general public mental health clinic, 90% of those kids are going to have one of
Bruce,
six.
Bruce, let me interrupt a minute. We're having a little trouble with your connection, and I think you're on a cell phone.
On Skype, and let me try.
We're losing some words.
All right.
There's probably no way for you to fix that. I think one of the things we could do is maybe have more of a conversation and let me help clarify what I'm hearing you say, because words are being dropped off just electronically. What we're going to do is we're going to go to break now, and I think my engineer will talk to you. The stuff you're talking about is as important as anything we could have on this show, anything. So I want to see what we can do. Even if we have to have you come back and I'll talk about these general ideas myself for half an hour and reset you at another time. But let's see what our engineer can work out with you, and we'll go to break, but I'm really interested in what you have to say. Hi, it's Dr. Peter Bregan. Do I still have Bruce Perry with me?
Fine. It may not be much better. I'm out in the middle of nowhere, so I apologize. I don't have very good reception out here.
Well, you sound better right now.
Good. Well, hopefully it'll last.
Well, you're talking about some very, very important things about how built into the child's nervous system are the responses to the early life stresses. And you kind of mentioned a variety of different stresses and how the nervous system, in a sense, I think one of the main problems you're describing is that there's a generalized hyperactivity of the nervous system that develops when a child is under a lot of stress.
Right.
I'm sure you can also talk about it probably gets more complicated than that, and I'm sure there's a numbing that occurs and we get these very mixed and difficult to simplify scenarios. And I'd like you to just, you know, pick up from there and talk about some more about your experience with, re-looking at the world in terms of what the child's been through right. rather than some externally imposed diagnosis, I think, is part of it.
Right. We, over the years, in response, basically, to the complexity of the brain and the complexity of each person's individual set of experiences, we recognize that the simple categorizing of problems, the way we were trained in psychiatry, was inadequate to really describe what was going on with the child. And so not only was it inadequate to sort of to describe the etiology of the problems, it was inadequate in helping us figure out the best intervention approach. So that the conventional rationale for having a diagnosis is that somehow you want that diagnosis to help you understand the etiology, understand the treatment, and then understand the prognosis. And since neuropsychiatric labels didn't help us do any of that, we stopped using them. And now we, for our research purposes, of course, we use them so that we can make comparisons with what we're doing. But in general, clinically speaking, we really don't ever think about the diagnosis. What we think about is the person. Where do they come from? What's their life history? What's their history of developmental challenges? What's their history of relational buffers? What factors of resilience are present in their lives? What factors of vulnerability are present in their lives? Who can we recruit to be involved in the therapeutic process? Who is going to be the mediator of regulation for this child? Who's going to be somebody who will predictably make the child feel disrupted? And so when we're doing our therapeutic work, we have a completely different approach now than we used to. And it's much more individualized, and it's much more focused on taking the time to really get to know the individual child, their family, their community, their culture, and then within that context, put together what we call the therapeutic web, which is to try and craft a set of relational connections and enrichment opportunities and educational expectations and when appropriate, therapeutic activities that will help the child essentially get back on a better, on a healthier developmental trajectory. And, you know, we have to say that the outcomes from that kind of approach are far superior to the outcomes that we were achieving when we used a conventional 1 hour a week, sit in a waiting room and then come see the mental health provider model. It's more holistic. It recruits the community and family to be essentially participants in the therapeutic process. And it also gives the child and the client a lot more control over selecting and sequencing and patterning the experiences that we think will help them get better. So it's a much more gratifying experience for the clinicians, and it's a much more, we believe, positive experience for the patient.
Bruce Perry, it's amazing. I when I speak to groups and try to summarize what I believe, I could use that paragraph from you as well as one of my own paragraphs. So we've come to very, very similar conclusions about what the issues are with childhood and children and ultimately with adults, because they just are the grown-ups. One of the things that you haven't mentioned yet, but which is in your work a great deal, is the role of empathy in this. And I think right. with the addition of that, it becomes our work becomes even more similar in basic formulations. Could you talk about where empathy fits into this in your work?
Yeah. Well, over the years, really, again, coming from the perspective of a biologist interested in human behavior, it was almost inescapable that human beings are relational creatures. you know, the huge portions of the brain are dedicated to social interaction. You know, the way our literally the way our face is even constructed, that we are designed to be in groups. So human beings are fundamentally relational creatures. And we the next book I'm writing is about neurosociology. It's about the neurobiology that connects us and what happens when that connection is fractured. And so empathy is essentially the glue that holds together a human living group. And it's fundamentally crucial for everything. If you're going to be successful as a parent, a teacher, a researcher, whatever you do, your success will be in some way related to your ability to form and maintain relationships. And the major vehicle for change is the relationship. And so empathic relationships are, and being able to bring empathy into a relational and interaction makes the efficiency of that relational interaction higher. There's more synchrony. Your ability to sort of get across your point to a child is going to be more effective if there's this empathic connection. Your ability to understand their perspective is going to obviously depend upon your capacity to be empathic. And so we've become very interested in the neurobiology of human relational interactions. And so, and again, this is kind of embarrassing, having been in the field, you know, I'm getting pretty old now, and it's amazing how often I run across work that has been seminal work, brilliant in its own little discipline, but that we've become so compartmentalized and fragmented in our world that a whole body of really, really relevant research can be completely unknown to another discipline. And I keep running into that kind of stuff. And so there's a really very, very rich body of work in sociology about relational interactions and how people function in groups. And what we're trying to do now is bring our understanding of the neurobiology of the individual and see where our understanding of how the threat response works and what regulates people and mirror neurons and all that stuff that we're learning, how that actually helps inform an understanding of a lot of these observations that have been made in sociology over the years. So it's,
you know, in keeping with that, Bruce, I 30 years ago, I was startled to find that Jane Goodall, in talking about chimpanzees, had more understanding of empathy in the chimpanzee community and its importance in the raising of young chimps than my fellow psychiatrists had for human beings. So
yeah,
we certainly do have a lot of richness outside of psychiatry.
Exactly. And it's interesting, one of the old famous, very important research projects that really informed cardiology, the Framingham studies, there's a group of sociologists that have been kind of, and other investigators who've been using that study to look at some of these fascinating aspects of human living groups. And so I'm sure you're aware of this, for example, but your listeners may not be, that when you look at an individual's sense of happiness, that one of the major determinants of how happy you are as an individual is how happy your friends' friends are. So if your friends' friends, who you might not even know, are happy, there's a higher probability that you'll be happy. And if they're not happy, there's a higher probability you won't be happy. And it's the same thing with literally your weight. It's the same thing for divorce. It's the same thing for fear. So the way you feel is influenced by people you do not even know. And that's a very powerful, you know, that the echo of our own affect out into the broader relational world, knowing that that has meaning and that that has impact on people that we don't even know, it's a very powerful thing. Again, those of you who have been reading about mindfulness or you know much about Zen Buddhism, that's something that they've been writing about, and as have other religious perspectives in many, many other ways. They've been using different language, but they've been making those observations. And now, of course, neuroscience comes along and says, oh, we've discovered this. But it's essentially using different language to describe something that, that other people have observed over the years. And it's one of the things that we've been incredibly disrespectful of in the modern world, particularly modern psychiatry. When kids get really sick, what do? We take them out of their relational context and we put them in a completely artificial relational context, a hospital. We, you know, and we keep them there for a little period of time and then we put them back. We create these artificial, you know, relational buffers, and then we yank those out from underneath them. You know, we do so many relationally stupid things in our interventions that are well-intended, but they're very developmentally and neurobiologically uninformed.
One of the observations I've been thinking more and more about lately that relates to all this is evolution itself, which is... you know, estimates are that we reached our current evolutionary brain stage maybe 100,000 years ago or 80,000 years ago. And the real basics of it much earlier than that. And all this is that brain, this huge brain that we developed that can accommodate modern technological life and create the internet and create art and literature and cities and various communities. All of this brain developed before we were even doing cave drawings, before we lived in cities, before we had much in the way of tools, that this whole brain that is so powerful, it seems limitless, developed, I think, for us to live in small social groups, that it was needed for the complexity of that kind of social living. Does that make sense to you?
Oh, absolutely. And I think about that a lot. I think about where we break down. You know, we have artificially, you know, it's a funny thing. Our brain has allowed us to create these incredibly complex systems, yet we still have certain limits to what we can manage relationally. You know, there's a number called Dunbar's number, which you're probably familiar with it. An anthropologist speculated that the cortex was, in primates, was related to the ability to manage these socially complex environments. So he estimated, based upon cortical size, basically what he did is he took a lot of primate groups and looked at the size of their communities and then looked at the size of their cortex. And there's a linear relationship between cortex and the number of people or the number of groups in your members of your group that you can successfully negotiate with, manage, and essentially have relationships with. And so Dunbar's number in human beings is about 100. And what that means is even though we live in a city of 1 million people, there's probably only about 100 people that we can maintain meaningful relationships with at any given time. And they've recently done analyses on Twitter, for example, where people have 350 followers and they have 1,000, quote, friends on Facebook. It turns out that the number of meaningful reciprocal interactions where you are having a back and forth with another human being, independent of whether it's Facebook or Twitter or living in a community with, you know, just a bunch of people, it's still the same. So even though we have these new ways of reaching out to lots of people, the number of meaningful reciprocal interactions is limited by our time and our brain's capacity to negotiate that complexity. And I think in some ways, many of our social ills are related to us creating systems that are very disrespectful of the need to be socially connected. And so school, where there's one adult and there's 30 kids. And, you know, we're increasing screen time and decreasing conversation time. The number of hours that kids spend in front of the screen is like, you know, 8 hours a day. And the number they spend in conversation with their peers or with an adult across the dinner table is plummeting. And so we're changing. But I think that when we change so much as a culture that we come up against these limits of what the brain prefers, that's where we get vulnerable, and that's where I think lots of illness comes. In fact, those people that have been studying these social phenomenon, one of the most powerful of these that relates to your work and to mine about empathy and relational connection is that when you break down the social fabric in a community, a family, you have increases in all kinds of stress-related disorders, diabetes, heart rate, depression, suicide, drinking. All of those things can be connected back to sort of this internal dysregulation that you're trying to manage. And at the same time, if you reweave social fabric, if you take a fragmented community and you reconnect it, all of those things go down. And so people that study population health, they find that the major determinant of the health of a population is not access to tertiary care medical centers. It's not taking Risperdal. It's not getting, you know, a board-certified child psychiatrist to give you medication. It's actually these social health factors, like how many grocery stores are within walking distance of your house. What percentage of neighbors do you know? How many group community activities do you participate in, like, you know, with the YMCA and Scouts, et cetera, et cetera. And the higher that is, the healthier you are, independent of genetics, independent of access to tertiary health care. And again, it speaks to the power of empathy, the power of the relational connection that literally is the glue that keeps human beings together. And I'm one of the things that I write about a little bit in some of our books is and writings is I fear that we have invented ourselves away from our nature. And that if we get too far away from it, that's where we get sick. And that's where we break down. And I think that, I think that that's an issue, particularly today in today's mental health presentations. The number of, you know, how many of these folks are isolated? They're away from extended family. They've got no connections in the community. Those are the ones that are vulnerable. And, you know, I know kids that have, you know, active psychotic symptoms. For whatever reason, they've got them, but they're in a healthy family. The family cares for them. The family learns a little bit about how to manage that. They don't panic, and these kids do fine. Anyway, I'm rambling.
No, you're not rambling at all. This is very, very important stuff. Bruce Perry, again, my guest, makes me think about the effect of psychiatric drugs, because virtually all psychiatric drugs are going to impair higher mental function, precisely the frontal lobe function that's needed for empathy and social relationship. So in a way, we cement people into their lack of relationship and make them numb to the experience of it.
Yeah,
there's no drug that's going to improve social relationship, and I think any psychoactive drug ultimately will impair social relationship.
Well, I certainly think that that's the case for the antipsychotics, for sure. I mean, they do two things that I think are really unfortunate. Is they actually inhibit the ability to get pleasure from anything. So particularly relational interactions. You know, one of the most powerful rewards that we can get as a human being is the attention and approval and a positive interaction with another person. But if you no longer can feel pleasure from that, it does exactly what you're saying. It decreases the pull to be social, which therefore decreases the opportunities to have social learning, to have cognitive learning, to have social regulation. All of the things that would help somebody heal and get better are inhibited by these secondary effects of the medication. And I remember, you know, the term neuroleptization, right? You know, that kind of zombie look.
Right.
We all who trained all saw it in people that were on long antipsychotics for a while.
We see a variation of that in the stimulant drugs, too. The stimulants we give to children, yeah, you give them to chimpanzees, all spontaneous behavior is reduced. All socialization is reduced, yeah, or crushed. They stop hugging and kissing, and they stop grooming, and they stop playing and fighting, and they isolate. And yeah, I think that we are isolating our children, somewhat different mechanisms, some overlap in the biochemistry. But I think the stimulants are doing the same thing, but less frequently do we get the obvious zombie effect, but we even get a zombie effect in some of the children as well.
Yeah.
I suspect that all psychoactive substances, whether it's marijuana or long-term alcohol or any of the drugs we use, they're basically impairing the highest mental functions, which means to begin with empathy, which I think is probably the highest mental function.
Well, I think there's no doubt that the medications and drugs you're talking about impair the ability to have rhythmic, relational, and rewarding interactions. Now, I think everybody who's out there listening can recognize that when an interaction with another person has a certain rhythm to it, it's more pleasurable. You listen, and then you talk, and then you listen, and then you talk, and there's a rhythm. So, like, even when you say hi to somebody, there's a certain period of time, and then they'll say hi back. But if there's a delay or a blunting, or it feels dissynchronous, it feels weird. And so you're right. Those medications all will change that responsivity, the reactivity, the rhythm that normally is required for a rewarding empathic interaction.
Talk some about the reception your work is getting and just related work that's going on. It's sort of an open invitation just for you to talk some more about your work.
Sure. Well, one of the things that we've done is we've been trying to be a little bit more systematic in helping people recognize how important it is to incorporate good history taking into the assessment and clinical problem solving process. So we've been working on a developmentally informed approach to clinical work, and you know, just because it's in order to export that, we've had to develop kind of a certification process, and you know, it's not something that I'm that interested in. I mean, we've done it, and we think it's important. But the bottom line is that we now think that we have a way to help clinical teams and teachers and folks who work with children look at them more in this developmentally informed fashion that will increase the probability that they'll see the child as an individual as opposed to a set of symptoms. And so in the places that we've been working with that have been trained to use this and have brought this into their residential treatment centers, their schools, their mental health practice, we've seen very positive outcomes. Places, for example, are seeing, you know, tremendous decrease in the number of incidents and restraints. Many of these places are seeing tremendous changes in objective measures of functioning in these children. There are some places that use things that, like the CBCL or the CAFIS or some other structured assessment. Those sites that are using this approach have much better outcomes than their treatment as usual process. So we're very encouraged by that. In several states,
but Bruce, I want to hear specifics about this. What are you having people come to you and you train them? Are you going there and you train them? And who are you training?
Well,
how long does it take?
We actually have been. We used to go to the site and teach them about this, but what we learned is that people learn in little bits. So like a one-day, you know, six-hour thing, people are, there's only so much you can absorb. So we've moved more towards a case-based, web-based training process. So we have sites all over the world, Australia, Scotland, all through the Canada and the U.S., Turkey, where people literally are able to either participate live using some of the new web-based technologies, or if it doesn't fit, we record these sessions and then they can have access to them later. So we have
I'm going to have to change our rhythm a little bit because we have about 4 minutes left.
Sure.
Is there some place where people can go and specifically learn about this training process? I find it really exciting.
The best place is to go to our website. It's childtrauma.org. Or actually, if you can't remember that, all you really have to do is Google my name. You might have to do a few clicks and surf around a little bit, but you'll ultimately get to our website, and then there's information about what's called the neurosequential model of therapeutics. And so we've tried to make this very affordable, and it's self-paced. It's web-based. It's archived, there's multimedia content, and we're very optimistic because a lot of states are starting to use this within the child welfare system. So many mental health settings are using this. We've had several things published that show good outcomes with the early childhood population using this approach. So we're cautiously optimistic that this is a step forward in looking at adult and child mental health in a way that's a little bit more individualized, that's really the underpinning of it is neurobiology, neuroscience, and the outcomes are very promising.
Bruce, we're going to be, excuse me, I'm recovering from a little bit of the flu. Occasionally it shows up in my voice. Bruce Perry, it is just wonderful to be meeting you on the air. Most of my guests I have met before in my travels, and it's just marvelous to be meeting you on the air.
Thank you.
I hope that we can have more contact. People can get you at, as you said, at childtrauma.org. We've been listening to Bruce D. Perry, M.D.'s. His books include Born for Love and The Boy Who Was Raised as a Dog. And I think where so many of us are going now is in the direction of a more sophisticated thinking about the brain and understanding that the brain is a psychosocial, with underline on the social part of it, a psychosocial organ, that we're in a way homo socio, perhaps, rather than Homo sapiens, not so much the wise thinker, but the social being, and that's what this huge brain of ours is about. It's what we're about as human beings. I'm delighted to hear that Dr. Perry is reaching out to develop some training programs for people. I hope you're going to be immensely successful with it, sir.
Well, I have to thank you very much for the opportunity, and I really do appreciate getting to meet you, and I hope we'll meet in person sometime.
Yes. Well, let's correspond some more. And again, thank you so much for being on the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour, Dr. Bruce Perry.
My pleasure. Thank you.